I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Attention is refocused on the Middle East as a coalition of military forces launch air attacks in Libya. We'll talk with Imam Muhammad Musri of the Central Florida Islamic Society about local reaction and thoughts on the recent burning of a Quran in Gainesville. But first, we talk with the head of the State Teachers Union, the Florida Education Association, about the new bill signed by Governor Rick Scott last week in Gainesville. The measure eliminates teacher tenure and creates new standards for evaluating teachers and students. Those conversations ahead on Intersection. The bill signed by Governor Scott has left a lot of teachers wondering about what the next steps will be as they prepare for massive education reforms to go into effect. Here to talk about it is Andy Ford. He's president of the Florida Education Association. Andy, welcome to Intersection.
Hello, how are you?
Very good, very good. Now, Governor Rick Scott visited Jacksonville late last week to sign the Student Success Act, and this bill changes how teachers are evaluated. It calls for developing standardized tests to evaluate students and calls for the creation of a merit pay reward system. Andy Ford, this legislation seems very similar to a bill that was vetoed last year by Governor Charlie Crist, and I recall that part of the Education Association's concern with last year's bill was that teachers and union members weren't really part of the deliberations, and of course the bill's sponsor, John Thrasher, was not an education expert. So this year, I understand you were brought into the process. You had Senator Stephen Wise, who was fairly well respected as a sponsor of the legislation, but you're not happy with this new law. How come?
Well, basically, the bill that the governor signed, Senate Bill 736, is almost the same as last year's Senate Bill 6 that teachers and parents opposed, you know, quite actively last year. During this process, Senator Wise did hold a couple hearings around the state. He did meet with us. But ultimately, our input was not taken into consideration when they drafted the final bill, which is a huge unfunded mandate through the creation of all these new tests.
Talk to us about those tests. What kind of tests are we talking about? Are they tests for students, and how will they be used in conjunction with the current FCAT?
Well, where the FCAT is used, that'll stay in place, but where we don't use the FCAT, there will be end-of-course exams that'll be similar to the FCAT for the purpose of deciding a teacher's salary, evaluation, and future employment.
And so bring us into it a little bit more, Andy Ford. Why are you not pleased with this? What kind of issues do you think it's going to raise?
Well, we think that the legislature adopted an attitude that you can fire your way to excellence, and if you just fire enough teachers, student performance will increase. We think that's kind of absurd, that what we need to be doing is building a system that supports teachers and students. If a teacher does have problems and then we determine that the teacher can't come up to the standard that we expect, then the teacher should be let go. But we think that we ought to try and fix the current teachers that we have, since we know we have a teacher shortage. And if you can't fix a problem, then you need to deal with it. But this bill just attempts to fire teachers based on students' test scores.
We had some reaction from what Governor Rick Scott had to say when he signed the legislation in Jacksonville. Let's listen to just a little bit of that.
We've got to make sure we recruit, train, and promote great teachers. If we don't have great teachers, you're not gonna get anywhere. We've got to have great teachers, great principals, great school superintendents, and we've got to reward teachers based on their effectiveness rather than how long they've taught.
So Governor Rick Scott there speaking at a school in Jacksonville when he signed this legislation. Andy Ford, when you listen to what the rhetoric that the governor is using, it sounds like he wants the best for Florida students, but you think that this process is not going to be bringing those results. How come?
Well, I mean, it sounds good what he says. But you know, you have to understand that he went to a corporate charter school in Jacksonville, not a public school. He doesn't really have much respect for the public school based on what we've seen since we've never had a conversation with him. He won't meet with us. But, you know, he just signed a bill that's a huge unfunded mandate. I don't understand how the people who voted for the governor could support such an action. There is no money to develop these tests that will be provided to the school districts. And then after we have the tests, there's no money to provide the merit pay. So this is a bill that's gets a lot of headlines, but it's not going to actually do much of anything unless they put some money behind it.
So at this point, though, this has been signed into law. Are there conversations that you're aware of in the districts as to where this money will come from? Because it has to come from somewhere.
Correct. And I think if you're looking at what the governor's proposing for a budget, we're looking at a 10% cut to education in this coming school year. So we're looking at layoffs, the elimination of certain classes, elimination of athletics. It's not the time to be talking about paying a few people more when you're not even putting in the money into the program to run a 180-day program.
Mm-hmm. There are some school districts in Florida that already have their own merit pay systems in place. And, of course, Florida has been taking part in the federal Race to the Top education program, which also has some rewards for good teacher performance. How do you think this new set of regulations will interact with those existing programs?
Well, the districts that are doing the current merit pay plan will have to change that because this new law conflicts with the former law. Race to the Top, they're going to have, districts are going to have to change some of their plans because this law conflicts with Race to the Top. It wasn't just not well thought out. It's not that we're opposed to paying great teachers more. It's just how you go about doing it. And should you really be spending millions of dollars using students to be able to determine which teachers should be paid more?
Andy, some of the other factors that are going to be used to evaluate teachers include the absentee rate of students and other kinds of intangibles, I guess, in the classroom. How do you think that's going to be calculated in the formula that ultimately evaluates teachers under this new legislation?
One of the problems we have with the bill also is the fact that the value-added model that they're talking about hasn't even been defined yet. So you're asking for teachers to buy into a system where you haven't even defined how the measurement's going to be achieved. They're just trying to do too much too quick. I mean, we all share the goal that we have to have the best teachers in front of every group of students there is. We have to be logical about how we're going to do it, and we have to be willing to pay for it. The best reform happens at the local level where the school board, parents, the union can sit down and talk about what it is we want to change and how we can go about changing it. This bill puts more control of our public schools in the hands of the Department of Education. So basically we're giving control of our schools to Tallahassee bureaucrats.
You mentioned earlier that the greater control, because of this new law, will be going to the Florida Department of Education. And recently there's been a lot of turnover there. We saw Education Commissioner Eric Smith resigning, then Willard T. Fair, the chair of the State Board of Education, resigning. What do you make of these maneuvers that have been happening just recently?
I think the governor behind the scenes pulling a lot of strings and irritating quite a few people. Basically, you know, it would be nice if we could get the politicians out of education policy. That's not a reality. But I think as long as the politicians continue to move a political agenda as opposed to what would be educationally sound for children, we're going to have these problems. The commissioner just wanted to leave. Don't know if the governor really forced him out or not, and the chair of the board was supporting the former commissioner, as opposed to the governor.
Andy Ford is the president of the Florida Education Association. Andy, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, we talk with Imam Mohammed Mousri about recent political events in the Middle East and North Africa on Intersection. Late last week, reports came out of Gainesville that controversial Pastor Terry Jones had burned a Quran. Then a video of the event appeared on YouTube. The news comes about 6 months after Jones had agreed not to conduct such an event, due in large part because of negotiations with the director of the Central Florida Islamic Society, Imam Mohammed Mousri. To get a feel for the reaction to the Gainesville situation and how events unfolding in the Middle East are impacting Muslims in Central Florida, we'll speak with Imam Mohammed Mousri. And Imam Mousri, welcome to Intersection.
Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you back in the studio. Now, back in September of last year when we spoke to you, you had stopped Gainesville Pastor Terry Jones from burning a Quran. Then a week or so back came reports that he and his followers had put the Muslim holy book on trial, had representatives speak both for and against the Quran, found it guilty of something, and burned it. Last time, you were heavily involved in this situation, but this go-round, You've decided to stay away from this situation. How come?
Well, it was clear to all of us that Pastor Terry Jones was trying to pull another stunt to get media attention. And when he announced his intentions back in January, we knew that the best course of action was to ignore him. And we requested that the media ignore him too, which that's what happened. No media actually went to his church, and no one paid attention to him. So the news didn't really register anywhere in the world. However, he and his crew had recorded the mock trial and the burning of the Quran and posted on YouTube, which was caught in some places, but the damage was minimal compared to last year's attempt.
Talk to me about that. Were there behind-the-scenes maneuverings to ask the media not to really cover this event? Was there anything, any kind of conversation like that, or was this just a kind of a subconscious decision to, hey, we're going to not put too much attention on this event?
Well, the first time I heard about it was in January, late January, when he posted a YouTube saying, now this time he is going to burn the Quran. And so I was approached by the media, by one local channel who came to interview me, and we talked about it. And then I realized that this could happen all over again. So I requested that they do not cover it. And same day, the Tampa Tribune also picked up the story and did an interview. And I saw a snowballing of this event. So we issued a press release asking various media outlets that in light of what happened last year and how damaging to the image of the United States and it could put a lot of people in danger, that we all pull the plug on Terry Jones and not give him the day in coverage. So after that, I think most people stayed away from the story. And we didn't hear anything until today from any respected media source on the story. And the only one that came out was really his own videotaping and posting on YouTube.
What are your thoughts on the actual event itself, burning the Quran?
Well, honestly, when we retire an old copy of the Quran, we do burn it in a ceremonial way. Out of respect, we don't want it to be, thrown away where it could be stepped on or desecrated. However, the way he is doing it, that he put on a trial, and it is very comical what he did, pointing himself as a judge and bringing witnesses who they are all made up and their minds are made up. You know, he is not a government. He is not a court. He has no right to judge a person or a book. There are millions of books out there that speak bad about his faith. He does not burn any of them. He was asked, I asked him, and he was asked recently, right after he burned the book, did you read the book? He said no. You know, how can you be the judge of a book when you did not even open the book and read it?
Tell me more about the retirement ceremony for the Quran. I had not heard of that, actually burning a copy. Is there a ceremony involved with it?
It's a minimal ceremony where if a copy has been damaged and, we want to retire it, just like it's done with some flags, we burn it out of respect so it doesn't, it's not torn and pieces are all over the place.
We're talking with Imam Muhammad Mushri. He's director of the Central Florida Islamic Society. You can tell us what you think about recent events in Gainesville and around the Middle East at the WMFE Facebook and Twitter pages. You can go online to wmfe.org/intersection to find out more. And of course, you are listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm Mark Simpson. I think it's safe to say that Pastor Jones' views are in the minority, but it does maybe speak to some larger fears about Muslims that exist in the United States. And former NPR news analyst, for example, Juan Williams, speaking on Fox, said that seeing people in Muslim garb on an airplane makes him nervous. And I wonder, how do you combat those fears about Muslims that still exist in this country? And occasionally you have these moments that seem to trigger those fears and concerns.
Fear always comes from the not knowing enough information about the subject here, Islam. If people know a little more about Islam and they would see how similar it is to Judaism and Christianity, that they share so much, over 90%, they would really not be afraid of it. Islam and Judaism and Christianity coexisted for centuries in the Middle East for the last 1,400 years. And they share the same commandments, the same prophets, the same belief in the same God, the same ethics, the same moral code. So, you know, if for someone who knows Islam, they would not be afraid of it at all, because they will see a big portion of what they believe in it. But for the majority who did not learn anything about, and admittedly in a Pew Research Center poll last year, about 50% of Americans said they had absolutely no idea what Islam is. They never read it. They never, you know, met a Muslim. So that fear of the unknown is what's at play here.
What I think is interesting, particularly about Juan Williams' remarks when he says he sees Muslims dressed in a traditional way on an airplane making him nervous, I think maybe subconsciously, or there's some psychology there that reaches back to the events of September 11th, where, of course, there were Muslim hijackers on a plane. But I think it's so interesting when you think about that event, they were dressed as Americans in business suits.
Exactly.
You know, so it you know, they weren't dressed in that traditional way when that awful event happened. So I wonder, knowing that and knowing the psychology, the fear, do you think, is there something that needs to be done for Muslims to work harder to assimilate, or Americans to become more accepting, or is there some combination of both there? How do you see the psychology playing out?
It's both. Muslims are pretty much assimilated. I mean, you can hardly pick a Muslim today on the job. They dress the same way like all Americans. But it is at the same time a responsibility on all people to be open-minded and not to judge people by the way they dress. Like you said, those criminals on 9/11, they did not dress in a special way. They dressed like you and me. A terrorist is not going to come in a special garb and board the plane announcing himself that he is going to be, you know, doing something awful.
Let's turn a little bit to bigger events happening on the international front. You know, since January, there's been a wave of change that's rolled across the Middle East and North Africa, starting in Tunisia, spreading to Egypt, eventually ending with the departure of Hosni Mubarak. And I know you're part Egyptian, and I wonder, what are your thoughts and reactions to what you saw as these events have unfolded over recent months?
These are very exciting times. 20 years ago, when change was taking and sweeping Eastern Europe, a lot of people in the Middle East were hoping that their dictatorships will end too. But 20 years passed by, and more misery for millions and millions of people kept happening. Now, very suddenly, this time around, people discovered that they have power in numbers, and they have power in communicating with one another. So as soon as the Tunisian model proved itself, it became clear to every Arab throughout North Africa or the Middle East that these regimes were really weak. And despite their horrible record of repressing their own people, if the people all at the same time come out with no fear, they can bring these dictatorships and end their misery.
And you still have family in Egypt and are in close communication with them. What are you hearing, and what were you hearing as those events were unfolding?
It was at times exciting, at times frightening. you watch something on the news and you're talking to them on the phone and you see the events as they are seeing them. And, you know, when the regime would not, you know, budge and they were demanding that the regime goes, there was this sense of fear that a wave of repression would come back. When the army stepped in, people weren't sure how the army would react because the army was the backbone of the regime. So it was moment by moment. It's like walking on needles, saying, you know, what will happen? So sometimes we spent until late night or early morning watching the news because of the difference in timing. And any new alert, they would phone and say, this is happening now, or we would call them.
Because there was times when communication within Egypt seemed to be very difficult. I wonder, were you ever seeing things in the American media unfolding and calling up and saying, hey, we're seeing this? Did you ever know of things happening before they did?
There were times where we did. There were times no phones. I mean, we would call for 2-3 days constantly, and the phones were, the lines were cut off, that we're not sure what's going on except following the media. And those are the difficult times when you can't communicate with your family and you know that the regime is capable of committing massacres in the dark. But as soon as the communication came back, we would find out everyone is okay, you know, that the hostilities were concentrated in one area in Tahrir Square. So the people were, you know, fearful for what could happen because this didn't happen before, you know, a historical change taking place before our eyes.
Did you have relatives that were going in Tahrir Square, and did they come safely through all the events?
Yeah, I have several nephews and nieces there who are young college students.
The demographic.
Yes, they went in Tahrir Square, and, you know, despite their parents who come from a different generation who are afraid for them, but the young people said, no fear, we don't fear. We have to take part in, you know, liberating our country from this tyranny.
It's got to be a moment of pride for you.
It is. I did not think in my lifetime that this change would take place. I mean, there were people who were born in this, you know, the time of Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, or the times of, you know, Gaddafi in Libya, and all their lives they have lived under one tyrant.
That's all they've known.
Yeah, they don't know anything. It's like prehistoric for them if you speak about, you know, prior presidents. So it is pretty exciting for the young people to say, well, we're not going to put up with this for long.
You know, are you talking about this in sermons at the Islamic Society of Central Florida, at your mosque? Is this a topic of conversation? How do these events unfolding play into the Central Florida Islamic community?
Well, the community comes from, in addition to American Muslims who were born here, the immigrants come from over 57 different countries. So we cannot really focus on one particular country, but rather we give a message based on the faith that change has to be peaceful. Change has to be planned where there are no casualties. Now, as much as the civilians on the streets in Cairo and other places have tried to be peaceful, the government crackdown was not that peaceful, and some people had given the ultimate sacrifice. So for many people here, you know, they were delighted that the disciplined youth over there were actually doing it without violence and showing themselves and their families and their country and the world that change could happen without carrying arms and without, you know, any violence. And that at the end, they have to reconcile because they are all one people. And that's a central message in Islam, that, you know, there has to be peace. And to bring change, you have to use peaceful methods also. And that was, difficult for many people in the past. They argued you have to use violence and weapons to bring change against tyrants.
Let me ask you about that, because we have seen where there has been a contrast, of course, has been in Libya. And we are seeing in the recent days airstrikes against Muammar Gaddafi's forces in Libya. A UN resolution has approved these military actions. And I wonder, from where you sit, Imam Mousri, how is this military action being interpreted among the Muslim community in Central Florida? Is this being seen as a third war by a Western power against a Muslim-dominant country at all?
Well, uniquely, this is not viewed that way. It is, for the first time, the U.S. Has played its cards correctly as far as, participating in a military action in North Africa or the Middle East. The Arab street and the people here in this community watching the events, they initially didn't want the U.S. to intervene. They wanted Libya to go the same way Egypt and Tunisia went. Peacefully, the demonstrators were demonstrating peacefully in Benghazi and Sirte and other cities, and they thought that in due time, Tripoli will fall and Gaddafi will go. But only when Gaddafi threatened and started using heavy artillery and tanks against his own people and, a lot of casualties, we start seeing people in body bags. That's when people were really appealing to the world to intervene, not specifically the United States, but the United States as a leader in the world needed to play its role. So, but still the Arab street and the community wanted the United States to do it through the United Nations. So it's not a single, military action, but the Arabs needed to participate in this go-around.
And, of course, we're seeing events unfold still in Libya and in all these other countries as well. Are you getting a sense, are people, Muslims in Central Florida, considering going back to places like Egypt, places like Tunisia, other countries where we're seeing great political change? Are we seeing a move to want to go back and be part of what will hopefully be these new countries' political systems?
There are many who has who has plans to go back. Some people have been in exile for 2-3 decades because of their political views against Gaddafi, for example, or Mubarak. And they miss their families. They want to go back even for a visit. They did not come here by choice. They were forced out in exile. So for these people, they do want to go back, and they have, properties there. They have businesses to reclaim. But for some of them, and especially their children, there's no going back. I mean, the United States is their home. That's all what they knew, and they left everything behind. It's gone a long time ago.
Imam Muhammad Mousri is the director of the Islamic Society of Central Florida. Imam Mousri, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Mark, for having me.
The conversation continues online at the Florida Talks blog. Find out more at our webpage, wmfe.org/intersection. There you can hear a web extra as Imam Mousri talks about the impact of President Obama's 2009 speech in Cairo on the events of today in the Middle East. You can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners like you. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.